At just after 7 in the morning, the call comes in. A woman has been shot inside her home. The door is closed. The house is quiet. 4 children are inside. Police arrive to a residential street in Ohio where nothing looks disturbed from the outside. No broken windows, no signs of a struggle spilling into the yard. Inside, the air is still. A mother lies dead. The children are alive. They are moved out, one by one, wrapped in blankets, eyes wide, not crying yet. Officers lock the scene. Neighbors gather. Someone asks if it was random. Someone else says it had to be personal. Investigators do not answer. This is not a burglary gone wrong. Nothing is missing. There is no forced entry. Whoever pulled the trigger did not need to break in. By the end of the day, detectives are no longer looking outward. They are looking inward, at relationships, at history, at a home that was supposed to be safe. What happened inside that house did not start that morning. But that morning is where it ended. Chapter 1, The Scene Inside the House. The call reaches the dispatcher early, just after 7 in the morning. The voice on the line is shaken. A woman has been shot inside her home. Children are inside the house. The caller does not know if the shooter is still there. Patrol units are dispatched immediately to a quiet residential street in Ohio. The neighborhood looks ordinary. Lawns are trimmed. Cars sit in driveways. Nothing suggests violence from the curb. The first officer arrives within minutes. He approaches the front door carefully. There is no forced entry. The door is closed, no broken glass, no damage to the frame. He knocks, there is no response. Backup arrives, officers announce themselves and enter the home. Inside, the house is silent except for the sound of footsteps on the floor. The smell hits first, metallic, sharp, blood. In one of the rooms, they find her. Keshana Anderson is on the floor. She has been shot, there is no sign of life. Emergency medical personnel are called in, but it is already clear this is not a rescue. She is pronounced dead at the scene. The children are located inside the home. All 4 are alive. They are frightened. Some are still in sleepwear. None of them appear physically injured. Officers move them away from the body as quickly and gently as possible. One by one, the children are escorted outside. Blankets are wrapped around them. A patrol car becomes a temporary shelter. Neighbors begin to notice the activity. Red and blue lights flash against houses that have never seen them before. A small crowd gathers at a distance. People whisper. Someone asks what happened. No answers are given. Inside, the scene is secured. Crime scene tape goes up. Detectives are notified. The house becomes a sealed space, frozen in time. Officers begin their initial walkthrough. They note the position of the body. They document blood spatter patterns. They look for shell casings. A firearm is not immediately visible. There are no obvious signs of a struggle in the common areas. Furniture is upright. Nothing appears overturned. This does not look like a robbery. Valuables appear untouched. Electronics are still in place. Purses and bags are not rifled through. The house looks lived in, not ransacked. The lack of forced entry stands out immediately. Doors and windows are intact. No shattered locks, no pried frames. Whoever came into this house did not need to break in. That detail shifts the tone of the investigation before the medical examiner ever arrives. Detectives arrive mid-morning. They take control of the scene. Photographs are taken from every angle. Measurements are logged. Evidence markers go down. The floor becomes a map of numbered points and red-stained surfaces. The children are formally identified. Their ages are noted. Arrangements are made to place them with family members while the investigation unfolds. Child Services is notified. A crisis counselor is requested. The detectives understand the weight of this moment. 4 children have lost their mother before breakfast. Time of death becomes an early focus. The medical examiner conducts a preliminary assessment at the scene. Rigor mortis is beginning. Body temperature suggests the shooting occurred hours earlier, likely during the night or early morning. That timeline raises questions. If the shooting happened earlier, who discovered her? Who called it in? What happened in the hours between the gunshots and the police arrival? Investigators begin canvassing the neighborhood. They knock on doors. Most neighbors heard nothing. A few mention hearing a loud sound in the early morning hours, but dismissing it as a car backfiring or fireworks. No one reports seeing anyone flee the area. Back inside, detectives examine entry points again. The front door shows no damage. The back door is locked. Windows are secured. This reinforces the same conclusion. the shooter likely had access. They begin compiling a list of people connected to the home, family members, friends, romantic partners, anyone who would come and go without raising suspicion. At this stage, detectives are careful with their language. They do not name suspects, they do not announce motives, but their attention has already narrowed. This is being treated as a homicide, not an accident, not self-inflicted. The position of the body and the wound patterns rule those out quickly. The weapon remains missing. That absence matters. If the firearm had been left behind, it could suggest panic or disorganization. Its removal suggests intent. Investigators process the room where Keshana Anderson was found. They document bullet trajectories. They locate shell casings consistent with a handgun. They mark blood pools and spatter, creating a reconstruction of where she was standing or sitting when she was shot. The house tells a quiet story. There are signs of daily life, children's belongings, school items, dishes in the sink. Nothing about the space looks staged. This was not a crime committed by a stranger passing through. It happened in a place where people slept, ate, and raised children. Detectives interview the initial caller. They record the timeline provided. They look for inconsistencies, but at this stage, they are gathering facts, not confronting anyone. As the morning progresses, the scene grows heavier. Each piece of evidence reinforces the same direction. No forced entry, no theft, a missing weapon, children asleep in the house. The investigation is already turning inward. By early afternoon, the medical examiner prepares to remove the body. Keshana Anderson is placed on a gurney and covered. As she is taken out of the house, neighbors fall silent. Some bow their heads, others stare, stunned. The children are no longer there to see it. They are with relatives now, beginning a life that will be permanently divided into before and after. Detectives step back inside the house once more. They know this is only the beginning. The scene has given them direction, but not answers. Someone who knew this home walked in and walked out after pulling the trigger. The question is not whether this was personal. The question is who crossed that line and why the danger came from inside the door. Chapter 2, The Life Behind the Door. By the second day, the house is no longer just a crime scene. It is a record of a life. Detectives begin building a profile of Keshana Anderson beyond the moment she was found on the floor. They focus on who she was, how she lived, and who had regular access to her space. This stage of the investigation moves away from bloodstains and measurements and into routines, relationships, and pressure points. Keshana Anderson was a mother of four. That fact shapes every interview. Friends and relatives describe a woman whose days revolved around her children, school schedules, meals, bedtimes. The house was active, loud at times, full. Investigators document her daily pattern, when she woke up, when the children went to sleep, who typically came by the house, who had keys, who was expected and who was not. They interview family members first. These conversations are careful. Grief is raw. Detectives keep their tone neutral and direct. They are listening for facts, not emotion. Was there anyone she was afraid of? Had she mentioned feeling unsafe? Were there recent arguments? Had anyone been told not to come around anymore? The answers are not dramatic. No one describes a woman who lived in constant fear. There are no reports of threats in the days immediately before her death. No emergency calls logged from the address in recent weeks. But absence of reports does not mean absence of conflict. Detectives expand outward, friends, coworkers, neighbors, anyone who interacted with Keshana Anderson regularly. They ask the same questions again and again, comparing answers. Did she seem stressed? Did she mention relationship problems? Did anyone notice changes in her behavior? Patterns begin to emerge slowly, not a single explosive revelation, but a tightening frame. Investigators confirm that there was no forced entry into the home. That means the shooter either lived there, had a key, or was let inside. This fact keeps the focus on people she trusted or tolerated. Digital evidence becomes a priority. Detectives obtain phone records with proper authorization. They examine call logs and text messages from the days leading up to the shooting. They are not reading emotions, they are reading timing. Who was in contact late at night? Who stopped communicating suddenly? Who sent messages that suggest tension or escalation? They also examine location data where available. Cell phone pings are not precise, but they can place devices within general areas. Investigators compare this data against the estimated time of death. The medical examiner completes the autopsy. The results are delivered to detectives in a formal report. The cause of death is confirmed as gunshot wounds. The manner of death is homicide. The trajectory of the bullets supports the scene reconstruction. This was not an accidental discharge. This was not self-inflicted. The report helps narrow the timeline further. The shooting likely occurred during a window when the children were asleep. That detail weighs heavily on the investigation. Someone fired a gun in a home with four children inside and left them there. Ballistics testing is conducted on shell casings recovered at the scene. The caliber is identified. This information is entered into national databases to check for matches with other crimes. No immediate hits come back. The missing firearm remains a critical gap. Detectives look into known gun ownership among people close to the victim. Legal purchases, prior incidents involving firearms, any reported losses or thefts. At the same time, detectives review past police contacts associated with the address and individuals connected to Keshawna Anderson. They are careful to separate documented incidents from rumor. If there were prior domestic disturbances, those reports matter. If there were none, that also matters. Interviews continue. Some are brief, others take hours. Detectives ask about arguments, about breakups, about control and jealousy, about money and child custody pressures. No single interview answers everything, but inconsistencies appear. Some accounts conflict on timing, on who was expected to be at the house, on whether certain relationships were ongoing or ended. Detectives do not confront immediately. They note the discrepancies, they log them. Pressure is applied gradually. They also examine surveillance footage from nearby homes and businesses. Cameras do not capture the shooting, but they may show movement, cars coming and going, people walking late at night or early in the morning. Most footage is uneventful, but even normal activity can confirm or contradict a timeline. By the end of the week, investigators have narrowed their focus. This is no longer a broad search. It is a targeted investigation centered on domestic access. The theory solidifies. This was not random. This was not a stranger. This was someone who knew where she was, knew the layout of the house, and knew the children were inside, proving that theory requires evidence that will hold up in court. Detectives consult with prosecutors early. They review what is solid and what is circumstantial. They discuss what additional proof is needed to move forward. Phone data, statements, ballistics, motive, opportunity, all must align. The emotional toll on the family becomes more visible as days pass. The children ask questions no one is ready to answer. Where is mom? When is she coming back? Investigators remain professional, but the human cost is never far from their minds. This case is not just about identifying a shooter. It is about explaining a loss that cannot be explained away. By the time the second week begins, the investigation has shifted again. Detectives are no longer asking who could have done this. They are asking whether they can prove who did. The house behind the tape is quiet now, but the life behind that door left a trail of facts, timelines, and choices. Someone crossed a boundary that night. Chapter 2 ends with the investigation closing in, not on a stranger, but on a relationship that turned fatal under cover of darkness. Chapter 3, Accountability and Aftermath. As the investigation tightens, detectives move carefully. By this stage, the facts that can be proven matter more than the theories that feel obvious. The case is no longer about what seems likely. It is about what can be demonstrated with evidence, testimony, and timelines that will survive scrutiny. Detectives secure additional warrants. Phone records are expanded. Digital data is reviewed again, this time with a narrower focus. They are not searching for new suspects. They are testing one direction from every angle, looking for breaks or contradictions. Interviews resume with sharper questions. Investigators return to people already spoken to, this time confronting inconsistencies. They clarify timelines. They ask why certain calls stopped abruptly, why messages went unanswered, why movements do not line up with statements already given. These interviews are controlled. Voices stay calm. The pressure comes from repetition and precision, not raised volume. Detectives know that small details, when revisited, often crack larger stories. At the same time, prosecutors review the growing case file. They look at what is solid and what still needs support. They consider the absence of the murder weapon. They weigh the strength of circumstantial evidence versus direct proof. The legal standard is high. A charge requires more than suspicion. it requires a narrative built entirely on facts. Eventually, law enforcement reaches a point where action is justified. A warrant is executed, or a suspect is formally confronted. The moment is procedural, not dramatic. There are no public speeches, no declarations of closure. An arrest, if made, is based on accumulated evidence. Statements, digital records, opportunity, motive as supported by documented behavior, not rumor. Authorities release limited information. They confirm that the case is moving forward. They avoid details that could compromise court proceedings. Allegations are clearly labeled as such. Proven facts are separated from what will be argued later. If charges are filed, the language is precise. The accused is named. The offense is listed. The court process begins. If the case remains pending, officials state that openly. They explain what is known and what is still under review. Silence is not treated as failure, it is treated as caution. For the family, the legal steps bring a different kind of pain. There is no relief in paperwork. Court dates do not bring back a mother. Answers come slowly and sometimes incompletely. The children remain at the center of every consideration. Their lives have been permanently altered. Guardianship arrangements are finalized. Counseling is provided. Schools are notified. Normal routines are rebuilt around an absence that cannot be filled. Community members gather for vigils and memorials. They speak her name. They talk about her as a mother, a neighbor, a friend. These moments are not part of the investigation, but they are part of the aftermath. Inside the justice system, the case continues its path. Hearings, motions, evidence review, each step is deliberate. Each delay feels heavy to those waiting. If the case reaches court, the story is retold in fragments, a timeline presented in hours and minutes, text messages read aloud, expert testimony explaining what happened inside a house while children slept. If a conviction occurs, it comes with a sentence that acknowledges harm but cannot measure it. If the case ends without conviction, the loss remains unresolved in a different way. Investigators reflect privately. They review what was done well and what could not be controlled. They understand the limits of their work. Justice in these cases is never complete. What remains undeniable is this. A woman was killed inside her home. Four children lost their mother. The danger did not come from outside the neighborhood or from a stranger passing through. It came from within a circle of trust. The house has long since been released from police custody. New people may one day live there. Fresh paint may cover old walls. But the events of that night are permanent in the lives touched by them. This case leaves behind a warning that cannot be simplified. Domestic violence does not always announce itself loudly. Sometimes it hides behind routine and familiarity. Sometimes it escalates quietly until there is no space left to retreat. The investigation ends where it began, with a closed door and a question that echoes long after courtrooms empty. How do you protect what looks safe until it is not?